through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
As a reminder, at the bottom of the hour, we'll have another chance for you guys to call in and enter our Open the Gates contest. It is a chance to get a pair of tickets to a sold-out Mariners opening day on Thursday, April 1st, against the Giants. You will also have a chance to open the gates to T-Mobile Park and welcome us all back to live baseball for the first time in a year. It's such an amazing contest. I think, the most excited for this contest of anything we've ever run. I think it's awesome. We've already had one caller win to enter his name into that. We've got two more chances during the course of our show today. So your next chance coming up again at the bottom of the hour. We're going to jump back into our conversation about the Seahawks' latest shuffle on the defensive line, bringing on Michael Bumpus joining us right now. Bump, first of all, how are you? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, guys. I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Good. So I'm going to actually kind of go backwards. We started talking about the reunion between the Seahawks and Carlos Dunlap about an hour ago. I actually want to start with the departure of Jaron Reed. What's your initial reaction to that news?
My initial reaction was I felt like somebody was going to have to go if this Dunlap move was going to be made. And Jay Reed was just being paid a lot of money on that defensive line. So naturally, he was one of the guys who could be sacrificed, I guess. So when it happened, I was a bit shocked. But I felt like, okay, if this move is being made, it's going to clear up space for another move. Hopefully, it's Dunlap. And that's exactly what happened. It's unfortunate to see Jay Reed go, man. I feel like he was playing really good football. He meshed well with Dunlap, finished the season in 5 games, 5 sacks, 2 against the Rams to lock the season out. But when you want to keep certain guys, other guys have to go, and it was Jay Reed this time.
Now, are you comfortable with that? You know, I think that's the next question is, are you comfortable with that being the case and not the team dipping into, you know, a Bobby Wagner restructure, a Russell Wilson restructure, you know, going to the player and it just not working out? You know, how do you feel walking away from that particular decision? Because people have been asking me, Bump, you know, well, how could they have avoided this? Well, those are two different options that you could have had that could have made it easier on you. What is your take on that?
No, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it because you're getting Carlos Dunlap, who changed this defense. Jeremy was already on this defense in the beginning of the year when they had, 8 sacks or something like that, 12 sacks in 8 weeks when they weren't really producing. Jay Reed was already there. So you want to hold on to the guys who changed the game. Now, will Jay Reed be missed? I think he will be missed. But I think signing Puna Ford is going to help you out. I think having the depth there is going to help. And I also think they're going to make a move at that D-tackle spot. I want most of my sacks, honestly, coming from the outside. It's rare that you get an Aaron Donald and a Chris Jones, guys that just every year are going to produce at that D-tackle spot. I'm okay with getting pressure off the edges. So if they didn't have the depth at that defensive line spot, if they didn't get Carlos Dunlap and bring in Kerry Hyder, I would feel differently about it. I feel like you would have to keep those sacks that Jaron brings to the table. But because you got guys coming back and I feel like they're going to make moves in free agency still, I'm all right with it.
When you're looking at the defensive line as a whole, I don't want to say would you rather see player X do better than player Y, but how important do you think it is that the drafted talent they have, that LJ Collier, Alton Robinson, and Daryl Taylor have breakout seasons? I feel like there's, even though they've brought in outside talent that's performed well for them, right? Jamal Adams, who obviously is in the secondary, but an important part of the pass rush, Kerry Hyder now, Carlos Dunlap, Benson Mayoa, all those guys are important and probably will be kind of their stars and make up a lot of the starters on that line. But man, I feel like there's a ton of pressure on those younger guys.
Yeah, there could be pressure, but I see it with all those guys coming back, the guys you mentioned, the Dunlaps, the Mayoa, Kerry Hyder now. I feel like that takes some pressure off of those guys. Because now Daryl Taylor doesn't have to come in and has to get 6 to 7 sacks. He can really just be a rookie, and whatever you get out of him, you'll take it. Now Alton Robinson doesn't have to feel a lot of pressure coming into his second season to be one of the guys. You have veterans that you're paying to be those guys. So I think in the end, it might help these young guys because there's less pressure on them. But now they have to go. You're in your second year. You're in your third year. You have a veteran in front of you who's going to take some pressure off of you. Now you got to see some results. LJ moving inside primarily, I think, is going to help him a lot. Again, Darryl Taylor getting healthy, Owen Robinson. And they're ball players. They want to perform. But I think having the veterans there, the guys you're paying a bunch to lead, will actually take some pressure off.
Now, Bump, at this stage, they've been able to solidify their pass rush. That's a huge thing compared to what has happened or transpired over the last two seasons. Now, where is the areas that they need to address on this roster moving forward, in your mind?
Yeah, man. I mean, they pretty much checked off all the boxes, right? You got offensive line, check. D-line, check. Signed your running back. Boom. You got a guy in the secondary. Honestly, I think you got to look at that receiver spot. I'm still looking for, if they're not going to give John Ursua a fair shot, or if they're not, or don't feel he's ready, or if they really feel Freddie Swain is their guy, then you leave it alone. They don't bring in a guy with a name and a background. But I like to see another receiver added to the spot. Gerald Everett is going to be that number three option, but there's nothing like having a true slot receiver. Maybe Freddie can do it. Maybe Ursula will get a look. But now you start looking for guys who can make impacts for the cheap. And you can every now and then you'll find a number three, number four receiver that's just fast, who fits your system, who can have two or three really good years for you. There might be a guy out there like that for him.
What do you think's been happening with Ursua? You mentioned his name, and I got to say, and I'm sure you see this on the text line, and I know Jake and I see it. When training camp comes around and you say Ursua's name and people hear about him doing things, you get like such a big fan response of, we want to see more John. Why do you think that we haven't seen as much of him on the field in the regular season?
Man, it's so hard to say, Stace, because we don't really know what goes on in VMAC, you know, when they're in those rooms. So there has to be something that he's not doing that other guys are doing. Because you don't just bring in Freddie Swain, a rookie, and he automatically gets time over Ursua. Coming into camp, when you get together, you want to see who has what. And typically you put your guys up front who have been there, unless you have a high draft pick. Freddie Swain came through the back door a bit. So there has to be something that's not clicking. You know, maybe he's not getting to the right spot on key concepts on time. Who knows? But they are keeping him around, so I feel like they're working with him, and maybe this is the year that he finally gets a shot.
Now, Bump, we just got breaking news that the Seahawks are signing Al Woods. He is coming back to the Seahawks. They are adding some depth there, clearly in response to the potential Jaron Reed departure. What do you make of that?
I like it. Al Woods, when he was here, man, take on the double teams. Be strong in there. And again, we talked about the interior linemen. I feel like that's where they need a bit more help and a bit more leadership. And boom, you got it. Al Woods is a pro. He's been there. He's done that. Take some pressure off of Puna Ford. When young guys don't have pressure on them, man, they perform at a different level. So I like the moves, man. I've been impressed. These guys have made so many transactions on the low these past 10, 11 days. And there hasn't been a move made yet to where I'm scratching my head.
Michael Sean Dugar just tweeted this a few minutes ago. I saw it on my timeline and immediately thought, yes, I've been wondering the same thing. And that is, KJ Wright's still a free agent and I don't understand why. Are you surprised KJ Wright hasn't signed anywhere?
Unfortunately, I'm not, just because of his age. And I don't know what he's asking for. I think KJ sees himself as one of the best backers in the league. In the last couple of years, he has been one of the best backers in the league. But, you know, once they look at that birth certificate and there's a 1980-something on it, they start looking at you a bit different. You know, there's a bunch of young guys in the league. So I'm not surprised. I think something will be worked out, whether it's with the Seahawks or with someone else. But KJ's going to play more football. I think now he's in the reevaluation process to, okay, do I bring down my asking price since no one's really bit the line yet.
Now, Bump, one of the other things that's kind of gone around this week is a report by Tom Pelissero saying that the Seahawks and Richard Sherman are open to a reunion. I don't believe we're getting close to that as of right now in the way the market is, but the fact that that is even being floated out there, that's even being a conversation that both sides would be open to it, is definitely eye-opening. What is your thoughts on it?
Man, initially, well, in the past, I've said, you know what, the Hawks should stay away from Sherman. Just move on and do your thing. But if I'm hearing both sides are kind of filling that out or whatnot, it's worth the conversation. I would say you have to be careful. There has to be clear expectations. Russell Wilson has to be okay with it. I mean, Sherm has to be Sherm, but this isn't his team anymore. You know, there's a hierarchy that goes along with this. If they can sit at the table and everyone's good with it, especially Russell Wilson, since he's your franchise quarterback and there could have been something going on there, then I guess you explore it. But I would like to think there are other guys out there who are probably cheaper who can help as well. But you never really cancel out bringing old Seahawks back, especially a great like Richard Sherman.
I'm going to jump back into what Jake brought up a little bit earlier, just talking about how you feel about the NFC West as a whole, obviously with the San Francisco 49ers making that trade to move up to number 3 overall, so they're going to get their guy of the future. How do you feel kind of the power rankings are right now? Because I got to say, I'm confident the Seahawks can compete for the top spot. Like, I don't feel like I'm solidly penciling them in any way for 3 or 4. I feel like they're competing at the top, but I also have no idea how the rest of it kind of shuffles out.
Yeah, the block is hot in the NFC West right now, man, especially with that power move by the 49ers. You know they're going to get a quarterback, so you're going to have a young stud in the quarterback. You're going to have a rising star in Kyler Murray. You're going to have the veteran coming out trying to resurrect his career. Then you got the franchise quarterback and Russell Wilson. It's going to be interesting. There's been a lot of movement going around in this league, but right now I would still put the Seahawks at top of the division simply because of what they have coming back and Russell Wilson. And I really feel Shane Waldron is going to take this offense to another level. But it's not an easy sitting at the top. I mean, there are going to be some fights this year. This is the most talented division when it comes to quarterbacks, especially after the 49ers make their move. So it's going to be a battle, but you got to play the games, man. And I think they're rough for the fight.
Now, the one thing that really catches my ear when I hear you talk, Bump, about the receivers in particular is looking at the opportunity to essentially try and see what you can get out of Freddie Swain, see what you can get out of John Ursua. Can they step up to the occasion and can they compete and really solidify themselves? If you were to place somebody to add to the competition, because I think that's where, if I'm hearing you correctly, that's more in line with where you're at. You don't want to necessarily add a veteran guy to overtake that competition, but to continue to add to it. Is there anybody on the free agent market that you would like, or do you think that they should address that in the draft?
In the free agent market, I feel like there still are a couple guys out there. I believe Sammy Watkins is available. I mean, but not the type of receiver that I feel like the Seahawks need right now. Mm. So I think they're going to address it in the draft. In the draft, you're going to have about 30 good receivers out there. 4 to 6 of them are going to be nice slot receivers. I think you can find a guy to take care of that problem in the draft. I wouldn't go out and spend a lot of money on a receiver right now. If you're going to spend more money, man, put it in that secondary, put it in the defensive line, because we know that this offense is good to go, especially with the signing of number 32. But there's this kid, Dwayne Eskridge, I believe, out of Western Michigan, who I think is going to turn some heads in this draft. And if he's available late, I think the Hawks should take a look at him.
All right. He is Michael Bumpus, joins us every Friday. You can hear him regularly on 710 ESPN Seattle. And obviously, once we get things going in the season, on the Seahawks pre- and post-game show. Thanks, Bump.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
See ya. All right. It is 12:15. That means it's time for Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
This is Four Down Territory, brought to you by Genuine Auto Glass.
With Jake and Stacy.
You live for moments like this. Time for us to step up and take it.
First down, Jake. Where does the Seahawks defensive line currently stand, given the latest move, adding Al Woods, adding Carlos Dunlap, and subtracting Jaron Reed?
Well, I think that when you look at the defensive line right now, the part that I love is their pass rush is at a place that I really, really, really like. And I think that it's a place that they should have been going after over the past couple years. Now you have Carlos Dunlap back. He can remain your number one pass rusher. He makes everybody else's job easier. Benson Mayoa, Kerry Hyder Jr., there's less pressure on them. Darrell Taylor, Alton Robinson, LJ Collier. What you have, Stacy, on the defensive line is fresh bodies. That's what you got to have. When you want elite pass rush, it doesn't just come from one or two guys. It comes from a group. And the reason why you're able to maximize your top-end talent and the, you know, second and third tier of your defensive line is because they're able to stay fresh. They're not being worn down throughout the game. And so that's something that I feel really, really positive about. Now, with Jaron Reed, It's unfortunate to lose him, but you can make up for that loss. It is easier to replace at the defensive tackle position than it is a number one pass rusher. So although I would have loved to seen Jaron Reed stay on the roster, be able to make it work, that would have been the ideal situation. We don't live in an ideal world. So you got to make up for it. You got to do different things and go with a different approach. And one of their answers is potentially going to bring in Al Woods, who will be at a relatively easy price point. What he is he's a one technique player. They needed to address this. I don't think this means that they're done adding to the defensive line, by the way. They need a three technique. LJ Collier can slide down and do that. Rasheem Green can slide down and do that. But I would be surprised if they don't add one more player on the defensive tackle position that can play that three technique role, that can adequately rotate with Puna Ford on their defensive line. This move by Al Woods is to make sure that you have a good run plugger that can rotate between Brian Monet and Al Woods, and I really, really like the move.
Second down. Stacy
Curtis,
hey. Explain
yes
the cap situation brought on by Jaron Reed's impending departure.
All right, so first I'm going to say the top five cap hits right now for Seattle: Russell Wilson, Bobby Wagner, Tyler Lockett, Jaron Reed, and then Dwayne Brown. So Jaron Reed and Dwayne Brown had roughly the same cap hit number. Reed's was 13.5 compared to 13 for Brown. So any of these guys were always going to be a primary target for some kind of cap conversion, whether it would be converting part of a base salary or cap hit into a signing bonus so that you can spread that out. Whatever it would be, these guys are carrying the biggest cap. And so when we were talking about contract restructures, in addition to Russell Wilson and Bobby Wagner, we also talked about Tyler Lockett, Reed, and Brown for a reason, and that was that they have a lot of money this year. So it's not shocking that the Seahawks went to Jaron Reed, according to Ian Rappaport, and reportedly said, hey, let's figure out a way to move some of this money around. You got a $13.5 million cap hit this year. Jaron Reed, in the final year of his deal, wants a long-term deal, so now the two parties are not seeing things from the same point of view. Jaron Reed is now on the move. Now, what that does, it doesn't free up $13.5 in cap space, even though that was his cap hit. There's a $5 million dead cap, which means money that they are paying no matter what. If Jaron Reed gets traded and plays for another team, the Seahawks are still going to pay $5 million. They're paying $5 million no matter what. However, there is a difference there. They save overall a little over $8 million because that would be the difference in his base salary. So another team that trades him would be taking that on, and the Seahawks are not taking it on if they release him or if he's traded. So they do free up some space. That doesn't give them a ton of space, though. According to over the cap, which doesn't include Al Woods, and I don't know that they have Dunlap or Hyder, the Seahawks are 7.6 over the cap. So they still need to create some room. The release or trade of Jaron Reed doesn't free up a ton of space. It does give them some relief, though, about $8 million worth.
Third down. Piggybacking off that point, Stacy, looks like Ian Rappaport tweeting that the Seahawks are leaning towards a release of Jaron Reed. So, Jake, what kind of market do you expect for Jaron Reed, and how can the Seahawks go about replacing it?
Yeah, I don't think Jaron Reed is going to see the market and have it be favorable to him. I think he's going to get a dose of reality here being on the open market, and that's why him not reading the market and then him also taking the proposal by the Seahawks and turning it down is a little surprising to me. Now, I don't know the entire details of the contract that was offered to him, obviously. But Stacy, as you were outlining, I have to imagine it was a conversion of this money into a voided year. So essentially, the team is saying, look, you're on the last year of your contract. Instead of, you know, going through a process of you know, having to play every game and having to work your incentives to get your max value of your contract, we'll just give you a signing bonus. We'll convert some of that money right now, today, and we'll give that to you. And you'll most likely be cut and released at the end of this season, and you get a chance to get into the open market. And Jaron Reed was like, nah, I don't like that. I want to have a longer-term deal. I want to solidify my future if this is what we're going to do. I just think that Jaron Reed's not going to get the same type of money. So out there on the open market. He might be okay with that with year one, but I don't see there being really a chance where the contract negotiation broke south. He goes on the open market. He realizes he was wrong. He's going to come back. This is a pretty stubborn move here by the player, and I don't think he's going to accept defeat by coming back to Seattle. I would be very surprised by that. So with that being said, this is a bummer. I wish that it could have been worked out on both sides, but I also do believe that the Seahawks have the ability to adequately replace Jaron Reed with another three technique type of signing. And you got to remember, there's people are throwing out their Geno Atkins out there. I mean, I don't know, man.
Danny Shelton.
I'm not necessarily a big fan of bringing in Geno Atkins. He's one of those players that to me looks at this stage of his career like he is over the hill. But maybe they deem him pairing back up with Dunlap that he could maybe get it done. I just don't see that at this stage of his career. Clear drop off in production in 2020. But, you know, one of the guys that I think would be interesting to me is looking at the fact that they're, again, going off of Brady Henderson's prediction and thought process here, that there could be a lot more free agents on June 1st than ever before. And if you're patient, you might be able to get a good defensive tackle on the market that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to get. So I think patience is the key in terms of finding an adequate replacement for Jaron Reed.
Fourth down. Jake, with San Francisco trading up to number 3 in this year's draft, who do you think they're going to take at quarterback at pick number 3?
Pick number 3, they are going to take either Zach Wilson or Trey Lance. That's who I am very confident in. It's going to be one of those two guys. Those are the two guys that have unique traits that I believe will easily be converted into the NFL given the right setup. Meaning head coach, offensive coordinator, offensive line protection. I think all those things can really come together for Zach Wilson or Trey Lance with the 49ers. And in my opinion, I think that Zach Wilson's going to be taken with the 2nd overall pick by the New York Jets, leaving Trey Lance to be a 49er. That is going to be my prediction with who is picked at the 3rd pick of the draft this season.
Did you see Bill Barnwell's tweet about who they should take?
No,
it was
I didn't.
A joke. But he goes, honestly, if the 49ers moved up to draft Kyle Pitts and just want to blow up the world with Pitts and Kittle, I would respect it.
Who do you got?
Exactly. Pick your poison. All right, coming up next in the timeline, the cast of HBO's Showtime Lakers drama series has some wild casting choices, including John C. Reilly. I can't wait to see this, though. Plus, we have your chance to open the gates to T-Mobile Park on opening day. Do not go anywhere. That's coming up next.
This is The Timeline
with Jake and Stacy.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It's 30 past the hour, which means it's time for us to open the gates on our phone lines and qualify another listener. Call 206-421-3776 or 866-979-3776 in 1 minute if you're listening on a radio or 30 seconds if you're listening to the stream. Again, 206-421-3776 or 866-979-3776. We're taking caller number
7.
Caller number 7, who will be entered to win the grand prize of 2 tickets to opening day and, this is the fun part, the right to open the gates and welcome fans back to T-Mobile Park. Your next chance to win comes in 1 hour at 1:30. Again, caller number 7 to 206-421-3776. Now for the timeline. Now, we're going to get things started. Thank you to Curtis for noticing this, because I actually didn't hear about it until Curtis tagged me in a video. Apparently, there was a giant ball of fire above Seattle last night. Now, initially, people thought it might be a meteor. It turns out it's part of the Falcon 9 space thing breaking up. I'm not entirely
like
sure.
Let me get you the exact, okay?
Oh, right.
All right, so the people aren't worried
right. That
it is aliens, okay? The Falcon 9 second stage from March 4 Starlink launch
what they want you to
failed
think.
To make deorbit burn
okay. And
is now re-entering after 22 days in orbit. Its re-entry was observed from the Seattle area.
Who told you that? The government?
So did everybody get that? Because
no.
I don't even understand what I just read.
It's aliens.
Yeah. So, no, it was just, look, you know, you got the SpaceX program that had one of their satellites or whatever fall from
space. Yeah.
Was it? But here's Curtis's and I theory on this.
Uh-huh.
Is that this was actually Brian trying to send a message to you?
Oh, you know what?
Just
so
letting
funny.
You know that he. That he cares.
It's so funny you guys say that. Brian actually is going to be here for opening day, so you guys will finally get to meet him.
Really?
Yeah. So he's been busy in space because my boyfriend is an astronaut, and but he'll definitely be here in person, and he's real, so he'll be here.
Okay.
And you know, you guys will have your wives and your families, and mm-hmm. I'll be there with my family too.
Yeah, it'll be
Brian,
great.
And yep. So anyways, moving on, the cast of HBO's Showtime Lakers drama series has some wild casting choices. Here's what we got. Comedian Bo Burnham as Larry Bird. You know what they have, by the way, the side-to-side pictures, and you're like, I can see how with hair, makeup, prosthetics, whatever you have to do to people to age them or de-age them,
mm-hmm.
I can see how all these casting choices could maybe work. You got Adrian Brody as Pat Riley. And then John C. Reilly is the Lakers owner.
I can't believe
it. And it's fantastic. But I can kind of see all of them. I can see Adrian Brody as Pat Riley for sure.
Yeah, when he's got his hair slicked back, I could definitely see that. The only thing is that Adrian Brody, his jawline is too narrow, whereas mm-hmm. Pat Riley, he's got like a full... like muscular strengthened jawline. So that's the only thing that's
true.
Getting me off on this. But I'm gonna wait and hold my judgment until we actually watch this and see this. Because right now I am completely thrown off and I can't believe anybody selected any of these people for the casting of this movie.
I was going to say, speaking of the timeline, we have another tweet from Adam Schefter here, but he was just saying that the 49ers have been planning or attempting to move into the top five picks for several weeks now. So they've already tried to potentially move up in a trade with the Falcons at 4, Bengals at 5.
Jimmy's our guy, though.
Finally.
Jimmy G's our guy.
Made it work at 3 overall with a trade with the Dolphins, decided to go as high as they could. There were no trade-up talks with the Jets for number 2, though.
I mean, yeah, I think the Jets would have, I think the Jets in their position would have asked for a lot.
Well, because the Jets are probably going to want a quarterback too. So they're like, if we're not going to be able to choose our guy this year and maybe not next year, then we want to know that we've got.
Oh, yeah. You want the first pick. I mean, you want to be the ability to pick, you know, the next guy right after Trevor Lawrence. You don't want to be, you know, at the mercy of everybody else and their evaluation and be stuck with someone that you really, truly didn't love. I mean, you know, so absolutely. It would cost a lot more to get that second pick from the New York Jets.
Did you guys, by the way, see the Cardinals and the Seahawks Twitter accounts engaging in some Twitter wars?
Oh,
yesterday?
Did I ever?
Twitter beef?
A Twitter spat? It's more hardcore than a Twitter spat.
More like
though.
The Arizona Cardinals embarrassing themselves. Did I not tell you that they spent $6 million just to try and troll the Seahawks and Seahawks fan? This had nothing to do with the play of Malcolm Butler.
It's a very expensive joke.
It is. It is, and the joke's on them because clearly they don't know how to deliver and they don't know how to get into a competition or a war of insults, as it were.
So the 49ers tweeted out a video of – obviously, the play that shall not be named from Super Bowl 49 with mm-hmm. with their new DB, Malcolm Butler. And then the Seahawks tweeted at the Cardinals saying something like, oh, where do you keep your Super Bowl ring? Or how's that Super Bowl
ring? Well, we hope y'all enjoy that Super Bowl ring in the building.
Exactly. And also kind of pointing out that, like, you're here making fun of us when you weren't in the game, in addition to just the other implication of
right
of
it wasn't
joke.
Even your Super Bowl
it wasn't
you
even had your Super Bowl.
You had nothing to do with that, and what Super Bowl rings or trophies do you have in your building? Absolutely none.
Well, then the Cardinals came back.
Get out of here.
And they changed their location to Seahawks Heads rent free which is funny. It is funny, but here's what I'll say about it.
No, it's not.
They started the entire thing by tweeting out a video of a player that was playing for a team that was not them against not them in the Super Bowl.
It's so bad.
On their field.
On their field.
It's so bad.
So who's living in whose head, Cardinals?
Exactly. It's just so unbelievably bad. Are we getting to the point where for teams' Twitters and social media feeds that they need to not just have content directors, but they need to have a trash talk director attached to that as well? If you're going to get into a beef with a rival, you've got to come out on the winning end, right? Like, you can't step into this and then embarrass yourself. I mean, that to me is a bad look on the Cardinals. The Seahawks won that one, clearly.
All right. Now, our winner for this hour was Mike in Lake Taps, but he couldn't stay on the line because he was working. First of all, Mike, best of luck. Congrats for being entered to this contest. Secondly, thank you for listening to us while you're at work. I hope you called us from like under a desk, quietly whispering.
Right. I won? Oh, sweet.
So my name is Mike. I'm from Lake Taps. Thanks so much.
I did have to ask him like three times to repeat his phone number because it did sound
most
like he's kind of
definitely
like,
was at work.
All right, sweet, yeah.
Can you imagine if Mike's boss is also listening and he's interesting?
Yeah, that sounds like
Mike from sales upstairs is currently calling into a radio show. Anyways.
I love it.
Mike, best of luck. Moving on, we've got some interesting sound from Nick Saban, and I think a lot of Seahawks fans are hoping that Pete Carroll is listening. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Rost.
This hour of Jake and Stacy is brought to you by the Pro Club. Nick Saban, the head coach of a small little upstart program down at Alabama. Little Alabama football program. Feel good kind of stuff. He talked about kind of the evolution of his coaching and said that he used to emphasize the defense and run game, but you got to win differently now. It's a really fascinating insight to hear from one of the most successful coaches ever. So take a listen to this sound, cut number three.
The game is different now. People score fast. Like, I grew up with the idea that you play good defense, you run the ball, you control vertical field position on special teams, and you're going to win. Whoever rushes the ball the most for the most yards is going to win the game. You're not going to win anything now doing that. Because A, the way the spread is, the way the rules are to run RPOs, the way the rules are that you can block downfield and throw the ball behind the line of scrimmage, I mean, those rules have changed college football. And no-huddle fastball has changed college football. So I changed my philosophy about 5 or 6 years ago. It was more than that. When Lane came here, we said we got to outscore him.
Now, there are two things that stand out about this, Jake. The most important thing is the way he says rules.
Yeah, is this Nick Saban or is this Joey Molinaro? I can't tell those two apart anymore.
He's so good at all those. The second thing is obviously that it reminds you of some of the critique that Pete Carroll has gotten. Now, what I will say about that, because that was how I found it on Twitter, was people being like, hey, Pete Carroll, what I'll say.
People are ruthless. Like, they were tweeting at Pete Carroll.
I know.
Just all over the place.
Now, what I'll say about that, Saban says, you know, I changed about 6 years ago, and I think at the college level he had to have changed a few years ago because that spread offense he's talking about is more prolific at the college level. Like, you're not going to face quite the same types of offenses at the pro level. You're going to, like, there is a level to what Pete Carroll does that's still going to work. And we know it still works because he's been so successful for so long. Like, it hasn't cost him the playoffs. It hasn't cost him, his division. It's not something that the Seahawks are looking at three seasons of fourth or third place in the NFC West. Mm-hmm. And they're wondering what's going on and they're not opening up their pass game at all. I mean, he's critiqued because his team is compared to the success of programs like Kansas City. And guess what? Every single team in the league that doesn't have Patrick Mahomes under center has people pointing at them saying, how can you be more like Patrick Mahomes? It's unfortunate. But I do think there are a lot of fair points here and ways that the Seahawks could modernize their offense should they choose to do so. And it's been, Jake, something that's been talked about for a couple years now.
It has, but I want to get into some specifics as to what Nick Saban has said there. And one of this is the RPO phenomenon, the transition in college football, how prominent that has been. And Nick Saban talking about the fact that it is so incredibly hard in college football to defend the RPO than it is in the NFL. Yeah. Why? Because in college football, they don't have the rule of linemen downfield is not as strict as it is in the NFL. The NFL, if they go 2 to 3 yards downfield when the ball is being thrown in the air, that is a penalty, and it's going to be a penalty every single time, and they never miss it. In college football, these guys can be downfield 5 yards in a run scheme and still throw the ball, and it's not a penalty. So it makes it so hard on defenses to know exactly what's going on, and you have to react to the run because they're giving legit run looks. So that makes it extremely hard, and if you're Nick Saban looking at this, you're going, how I would be a fool to not take advantage of that rule myself on the offensive side of the ball. And then the other side of it is the revolution and phenomenon of that and spread offenses and the explosion of points in college football, whereas Jimmy Lake at UW has rolled back into what Nick Saban is talking about. Nick Saban's saying, I got away from the brand of football that Jimmy Lake wants to walk into because it is so hard to win that way now. It's about outscoring your opponent rather than trying to play smash mouth ball control type of football. And so I think that's a unique perspective from a guy like Nick Saban, who comes from the same background and ideology and philosophy of someone like Pete Carroll and also Bill Belichick. And that's why I pointed to Belichick as kind of the rule of thumb or the model, is his willingness to be adaptable is absolutely marked through the years. Mm-hmm. Where initially when he came to New England, they were a defense, ball control, offense. In the middle of his tenure in New England with Tom Brady, they became a high-flying spread passing offense, an explosive scoring offense. And then towards the end of Tom Brady's tenure in New England, they went kind of back to that old, formula of defense and ball control. So in the NFL, you still have to have a physical running game. You still have to have a physical presence. That's why you look at Green Bay and what they did. Aaron Rodgers had great stats, but they also ran the ball pretty effectively. They had a strong physical running presence. So it comes down to how effective can you be on first and second down. And that, to me, is when you talk about modernizing the offense for the Seahawks, it's not that you need to get away from the running game or you need to abandon that whatsoever. It's about how can you be as effective as possible on first and second down.
Well, and I do think that Pete Carroll's emphasis on the run this year is being compared way too much to his emphasis on it in 2018.
Yes.
And I did not interpret it as that. I interpreted in 2018, he was like, we need to be better at this. And then they made more immediate moves to make it clear what their plan was. They took the top blocking tight end in the draft, Will Disley. They drafted a running back with their first overall pick, and they brought in DJ Fluker and Gerald Everett.
J.R. Sweezy. Yes.
And they, not Gerald Everett, who was, oh my gosh, I'm blanking on him, from Oregon. Ed Dixon. They brought in Ed Dixon, a bunch of like blocking tight ends and great run blockers on the offensive line and a running back with the first overall pick. Like, they wanted to be a run team. And you know what? They got there. They were the number one rushing offense in the league. When he said, I want to emphasize the run more this year, I didn't see the same approach. I saw it as like, we just need to bump it up a little. Right. We need to adapt more.
Well, and look at the additions that they made. Gabe Jackson is not... He's more known as being a pass protector than he is a run blocker.
Right.
Now, he's not a liability at run blocking by any stretch. He's a very good guard, but that's what he's known for, is being a great pass protector. Gerald Everett is not known for being this tremendous run blocker. He's not a liability, but he is known for being a chess piece in the passing game. So I don't see the additions that they have made, going to your point, being more of 2018. It's just revising what you've done.
Like a boost.
But Ben Baldwin put out there an interesting stat of every year that the Seahawks have moved on from an offensive coordinator is the highest totals of that tenure of that offensive coordinator in their aggressiveness in passing on first and second down. So Bevel, the year he got fired, was when he passed the most on first and second down. Shoddy passed the most on first and second down. And that's something that I hope doesn't go away in terms of the modernization of this offense. I'm not saying don't run the football. You want to run the football you know, on first and second down from time to time. But don't take the hands out of Russell. Don't take the ball out of Russell Wilson's hands on first and second down, because you know where he was most effective this year, Stacey?
Was it first and second
down? It was first and second down. He was unbelievable in first and second down when he passed the football. You know the area that he stunk at this year?
Oh, gosh. Was it third down?
It was third down.
Oh,
you pointed to
so
it all
good
year
at this
long.
Test.
So now can you fix that? Can you make your offense better by building off of what you did a year ago and being better on first and second down in 2020 and still having a very well-balanced offense that had a strong running presence and be able to be better at your execution on third down? To me, that is going to be the biggest aspect of it, because in 2017, when Bevel got fired for passing it on first and second down, it's because they didn't have a running game.
Mm-hmm.
They had zero running game. They couldn't run the ball to save their lives. Russell Wilson was your leading rusher. So you have a good thing going here for your offense. You don't want to go backwards. You want to continue to build forward. And so that finding that balance, finding that effectiveness with the run game, being able to tie it all together is going to be the key. So as Nick Saban talks about his evolution, I hope that we continue to see that with Pete Carroll in his own way. But it doesn't need to come in the same form of Nick Saban and the spread offense and RPO, because that's the difference between college football and the NFL and the rules that are very, very different.
All right, we have a fun interview for you guys. We have Fox Sports' Mark Titus and Tate Frazier from Titus and Tate that are both going to join us.
I can't wait for this.
They're hilarious. They know a ton about college hoops, and they're going to help us preview the Sweet 16 and the men's tourney that's coming up next.